Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really core concept in biology, phylogeny.
Right.
We've got some great material here from Dr. Tysium Hoffman's lectures, really digging into how scientists classify life.
Yes, fundamental stuff.
And our mission really is to get past just definitions and understand this idea of classifying based on who's related to whom, their ancestry, not just, what they look like.
Exactly. And that difference, ancestry versus appearance, that's the big shift Dr. Hoffman highlights right at the start. I mean, for ages, we grouped things by, does it swim? Does it fly? Pretty basic stuff.
Based on function or looks.
Right. But the game changer was realizing everything shares a common ancestor. Once you get that, shared ancestry becomes the only logical way to group things. That's phylogeny in a nutshell.
And Dr. Hoffman gives a great example straight off the bat to show why just looking is, often wrong. The Eastern glass lizard.
Yes, the class.
You look at it, no legs, your brain instantly screams snake.
And that's precisely the trap phylogeny helps us avoid. If you put the glass lizard with snakes, based on that one trait, you're missing the real story. Genetically, it's actually much closer to lizards that do have legs.
So what's going on? That's convergent evolution, isn't it?
That's it, exactly. Convergent evolution. It's this fascinating thing nature does where totally separate lineages facing similar problems independently evolve similar solutions.
Like similar pressures lead to similar adaptations, even if they aren't closely related.
Precisely. So the glass lizard lost its limbs. The ancestors of snakes lost their limbs. Probably because, burrowing or moving through dense grass made legs less useful, maybe even a hindrance.
Okay.
So these features, like the limbless body, they look the same. They might even function the same. They're called analogous structures.
Analogous, meaning similar function, different origin.
Right. They didn't inherit limblessness from a recent shared ancestor that was already limbless. Dr. Hoffman really stressed this analogy is foolish. They make appearance-based classification unreliable.
So, okay, if looking isn't enough, we need a better tool, and that's the phylogenetic tree, right? Dr. Hoffman introduced this as the main way we map out life's history based on actual data.
Yeah, think of it like a family tree, but for species, going back millions, even billions of years. Darwin's idea, but now powered by genetics and tons of data.
So how does this tree, this map, actually work? What are the key parts?
Well, the lines themselves represent lineages. Just think of an unbroken chain of parents and offspring through time.
Okay, a continuous line of descent.
Exactly. And then you have the really crucial points, the nodes.
The branching points. That's where things diverge.
Precisely. A node represents a speciation event. It's that moment in history where one ancestral lineage split into two distinct new species. They go their separate ways, evolutionarily speaking.
So if you trace two branches, say lions and tigers, back to the point where they meet, that node is their MRCA, their most recent common ancestor.
You got it. The MRCA. It's the ancestor they both share, but don't share with, say, a house cat until you go further back down the tree to an older node.
Right.
And Dr. Hoffman made a good point that most recent is always relative. The MRCA of you and your sibling is your parents. The MRCA of humans and chimps is much, much further back. It depends on the group you're looking at.
Okay, that makes sense. And this whole structure, these nested groups of relatedness, that leads us into taxonomy, right? The formal system of naming and classifying.
That's the one. We still often use the traditional ranks you probably learned in school. Kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, that nested hierarchy.
Yeah, King Philip came over for good soup or something like that. Yeah, whatever mnemonic works. But Dr. Hoffman pointed out that the really big fundamental divisions we use now based on deep ancestry are the domains.
Right, the three domains, bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. And the split here is kind of interesting, isn't it? It doesn't quite match the old cell type divisions. It is interesting. For a long time, biologists basically saw two types of cells, prokaryotic, simple, no nucleus, and eukaryotic complex with a nucleus.
Like our cells.
Exactly. But the genetic data show that the prokaryotes weren't one unified group. They actually split into two completely separate domains, bacteria and archaea.
So even though bacteria and archaea both look like simple cells under a microscope, they're fundamentally different branches of life way back.
Deeply different. Genetically, biochemically. So eukarya, that's us. Plants, fungi, amoebas, anything with a complex cell is one domain. Then you have bacteria and you have archaea. Three distinct domains.
Wow. Okay. And then within this structure, we use the specific naming system.
Binomial nomenclature. Yeah, the two-part name. Dr. Hoffman reminded us, It's always genus, capitalized and italicized, then species, lowercase italicized, like Homo sapiens for us, or Panthera pardu for a leopard. Gives everything a unique scientific address.
And this isn't just academic classification. Dr. Hoffman brought up a really practical, almost forensic application involving whales.
Ah, yes, the whale meat example. It's a great illustration. Imagine law enforcement finds some butchered whale meat. Visually, it's impossible to tell if it's from, say, a mink whale, which might be legal to hunt in some places, or a humpback whale, which is protected.
Right. It just looks like meat.
But they can take a DNA sample, compare it to known whale DNA sequences, and build a small phylogenetic tree. That tree will show exactly where the sample fits, which species it clusters with.
So they can definitively say this meat came from an illegally hunted species.
Yeah.
Phylogeny as a legal tool.
Exactly. It moves from the textbook right into conservation and law enforcement. Pretty powerful.
Definitely. Yeah. But, you know, even with these powerful tools, Dr. Hoffman was clear. Any phylogenetic tree we build is a hypothesis. It's our best interpretation of the data, but it's not absolute fact. It has to be testable.
Absolutely critical point. Science progresses by testing hypotheses, and phylogeny is no different. And sometimes the data just isn't clear enough, which leads to specific features on the tree. Dr. Hoffman talked about polytomies.
Polytomies. That's when a node, instead of splitting into two branches, splits into three or more. Like a fork with too many tines.
Precisely. And biologically, a single ancestral species splitting instantly into, say, three or four new species simultaneously is incredibly unlikely. Speciation usually happens in pairs, one split at a time.
So what does a polytomy actually mean on a tree diagram?
It's basically an admission by the scientists that they don't have enough data or the right kind of data to resolve the branching order. The speciation events might have happened really close together in time, and the current evidence can't tell us which split came first, second, etc.
So it's like a we don't know yet marker on the map.
Exactly. It signals where more research, maybe more genetic data or different analysis methods is needed.
Okay, so sometimes the data is unclear. But what if you have, say, two or three different trees, fully resolved, no polytomies, but they show slightly different relationships? How do scientists pick the best hypothesis?
Ah, now we get into a core principle of science. Parsimony.
Sounds like being frugal.
In a way. It's related to Occam's razor, the idea that the simplest explanation is usually the best. In phylogeny, the simplest tree, the most parsimonious one, is the one that requires the fewest evolutionary changes like mutations or reversals to explain the observed traits or DNA sequences in the species you're studying.
Fewer steps means it's more likely.
Generally, yes. Dr. Hoffman used a simple example. Imagine comparing three species. Tree A can explain their differences with six evolutionary events, say six specific mutations. Tree B needs seven events. Tree C also needs seven.
You'd favor tree A.
You'd favor tree A because it makes fewer assumptions about evolutionary changes having occurred. It's the most parsimonious explanation of the data you have right now.
Got it. Fewer evolutionary hoops to jump through. Now, we've talked about building the tree and choosing the best one. Let's go back to the groups on the tree. Dr. Hoffman defined three ways to classify groups based on how they relate to that MRCA, the common ancestor.
Right. And this is crucial for modern classification. The only type of group considered scientifically valid in phylogeny is a monophyletic group, also called a clade.
Monophyletic. Meaning?
It means the group includes the most recent common ancestor, MRCA, and all of its descendants. Every single one. Nothing left out, nothing extra added. Think of drawing a circle around a node and everything that branches out from it.
Okay, the MRCA plus everybody who evolved from it. Complete family unit.
Exactly. Now, the other two types are considered, well, problematic for classification because they don't reflect the full evolutionary history accurately. First is the paraphyletic group.
Para, meaning beside or near.
Sort of. It includes the MRCA, but it leaves out some of the descendants. The classic example Dr. Hoffman likely mentioned is the traditional group reptiles.
Right, because it usually includes turtles, lizards, snakes, crocodiles.
Uh-huh. But it excludes birds, even though birds evolved directly from within that group of dinosaurs, which are reptiles. So defining reptiles without birds makes it paraphyletic. You've chopped off a branch that rightly belongs.
I see. It includes the ancestor, but not all the kids.
You got it. And the third type is the polyphyletic group.
Poly meaning many.
Yeah. This group is formed by grabbing organisms from different branches of the tree that do not share an immediate common ancestor relevant to the group definition. Usually this happens because of
convergent evolution, like grouping the glass lizard and snakes.
Exactly. You're grouping them based on a similar trait, limblessness, that evolved independently. Their actual MRCAs are much further back down the tree and aren't included in the logic of that grouping. It's an artificial group based on analogy, not homology or shared ancestry.
So monophyletic, good, reflects real history. Paraphyletic and polyphyletic, bad, or at least not evolutionarily sound groupings.
That's the modern phylogenetic perspective, yes.
Yeah.
And defining these groups relies on looking at shared characters the traits organisms have in common. But Dr. Hoffman added a really important nuance here. Whether a character is considered ancestral or derived is totally relative.
Meaning it depends on what group you're comparing.
Precisely. Let's take the amnion, that protective membrane around the embryo. Mammals, birds, and reptiles all have it. Amphibians and fish don't.
Okay.
So if you're comparing reptiles, birds, and mammals, amniotes, to amphibians, non-amniotes, the amnion is a shared derived character. It's a novelty that defines the amniote group, separating it from the ancestors.
Derived because it evolved in that lineage.
Right. But now let's zoom in and just look at, say, turtles, lizards, and mammals. They all have the amnion. Within that group, the amnion is now a shared ancestral character. They all inherited it from their common amniote ancestor way back when. It doesn't help distinguish between turtles and lizards.
Ah, okay. So derived means new relative to the ancestor outside the group, and ancestral means already present in the common ancestor of the group we're currently looking at.
You've nailed it. It's all about the frame of reference, the specific node on the tree you're focusing on.
Okay, shifting gears slightly. The tree tells us who is related, but what about when these splits happened? Dr. Hoffman introduced the molecular clock. How does DNA tell time?
It's a fascinating concept. The basic idea relies on the fact that mutations, small random changes in DNA, happen over time. And for many parts of the genome, they seem to accumulate at a roughly constant average rate.
Like a ticking clock, but with mutations instead of seconds.
Sort of, yeah. It's not perfectly regular, but averaged over long periods, it's consistent enough. So if you compare the DNA sequences of two species, the number of differences between them is roughly proportional to the time since they diverged from their common ancestor.
More differences means they split longer ago.
Generally, yes. So scientists can calibrate this clock. They take species pairs where they have a good estimate of the divergence time from the fossil record, plot that time against the number of genetic differences they measure.
Okay, time on one axis, mutations on the other.
And they look for a linear relationship, a line of best fit. That line is the molecular clock for that gene or set of genes.
And once you have that calibrated line,
you can take two other species, maybe ones with no fossil record, measure their genetic difference, find that number on the mutation axis, the y-axis, go across to your line, and then drop down to the time axis, the x-axis, to estimate when they diverged.
Wow. And Dr. Hoffman showed how this was used to trace the history of diseases, right? Like HIV.
Yes, the HIV example is a landmark case. Scientists took samples of the virus from different patients at different times, sequenced them, and counted the mutations that had accumulated.
Yeah.
By plotting these differences against the time the samples were taken, they could establish the mutation rate, the speed of the HIV molecular clock. Then they could extrapolate that line backward in time.
Back to zero mutations, back to the beginning.
Back to the point where the line hits zero genetic divergence relative to the ancestral strain that jumped to humans. And doing that, the data suggested the origin of the main HIV pandemic strain in humans was likely around the 1930s.
The 1930s. That's much earlier than the epidemic was recognized in the 80s.
Much earlier. There's always a range of uncertainty. Of course, Dr. Hoffman probably mentioned it could be as early as the 1910s or into the 1940s. But it powerfully demonstrated that the virus had been circulating silently for decades before exploding into global awareness. A real triumph of applying evolutionary thinking.
Incredible. Okay, let's zoom out one last time to the biggest picture.
Mm.
The whole tree of life, those three domains. Dr. Hoffman pointed out a relationship there that still kind of surprises me.
You mean the relationship between archaea and eukarya?
Yeah. We talked about bacteria and archaea both being simple prokaryotes, right? But the tree shows archaea are actually more closely related to us, the eukarya, than they are to bacteria.
It's true. Despite the vast difference in cell structure between archaea, prokaryotic, and eukarya, eukaryotic, the genetic and molecular data places them as sister groups. Bacteria branched off first, representing a much older, more fundamental split in the history of life.
So appearance prokaryotic versus eukaryotic is misleading even at the highest level.
Absolutely. Deep ancestry trumps superficial similarity again.
Okay, so building this huge tree, mapping billions of years based on inheritance from parent to offspring, that's complex enough. But then Dr. Hoffman throws another complication into the mix, horizontal gene transfer, HGT.
Ah, yes, HGT. This really messes with the simple tree model, especially for early life.
Horizontal, meaning genes jumping sideways, not parent to child.
Exactly. It's the transfer of genetic material between organisms that aren't ancestor and descendant. Think bacteria picking up stray DNA from their environment, or viruses carrying genes from one host species to another, completely unrelated one.
And why is that such a problem for phylogeny?
Because the whole idea of a phylogenetic tree is based on vertical inheritance genes passing down through lineages. If genes are also moving horizontally across lineages, it creates conflicting signals in the data. One gene might suggest species A is close to species B, while another gene acquired through HGT might suggest species A is close to species Z way over on another branch.
So it tangles the branches.
It makes it less like a clean tree and more like a complex web or network, especially near the base of life where HGT was likely very common among single-celled organisms. Dr. Hoffman likely explained that this makes reconstructing the very earliest branches incredibly difficult and means the simple tree is, well, an oversimplification for that part of life's story.
Right. It adds a whole layer of complexity.
It certainly does.
So wrapping this up, Dr. Hoffman's lecture really hammered home that phylogeny isn't just about drawing diagrams. It's a robust, data-driven way to form hypotheses about the true evolutionary relationships of all life, moving way beyond just how things look.
Definitely. It's about uncovering the historical narrative written in DNA and shared traits, constantly testing and refining our understanding based on evidence, and that testability is key, even for things long extinct.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, like the relationship Dr. Hoffman would have outlined between birds, crocodiles, and dinosaurs. That tree structure isn't just lines on paper. It generates predictions.
Right. The tree predicts they share certain traits or behaviors because of their common ancestry.
So knowing birds and crocs tend their nests, the hypothesis derived from the tree predicts that their extinct relative, the dinosaur, likely did too.
Uh-huh.
And even though we can't watch a dinosaur, scientists went out and found fossils. Dinosaurs literally fossilized, sitting on nests, protecting eggs. It's amazing confirmation from the past, supporting a prediction made by the phylogenetic hypothesis.
It's a beautiful example. It shows these trees aren't just descriptive. They're predictive and fundamentally testable, constantly being updated as we unearth more evidence about the history of life. A really powerful scientific framework.
Absolutely. A fantastic deep dive into understanding life's true connections.